Hi, everyone. This episode is the fourth in a series of eight podcasts we're doing on the IB approaches to learning skills, known as the ATLs, which are at the core of all four international baccalaureate programs. My guest is John Harvey, an experienced IB coordinator who has led this work in multiple schools. It's our goal to give you a coherent, sustainable, values-aligned strategy to implement ATL skills in your school. We're also offering an opportunity for interaction. In our podcast notes, you will find a link to a Google form where you can ask questions. We will take a few minutes at the end of each episode to answer questions you have about the ATLs in your context. Of course, as a podcast, we cannot answer live, but John will continue to respond after these episodes are produced, so please feel free to pose your questions anytime. Welcome to IB Matters, a podcast for those who currently teach, lead, attend, or are interested in international baccalaureate IB schools. Hi, folks, and welcome back to IB Matters. We're here with our fourth installment of our Approaches to Learning series with our guest, John Harvey, and today's episode is about research skills. So you know what our goals are for listening today. We want to first start out talking about reflecting on the skill indicators for information literacy and media literacy and understand to what extent can they be merged. Also, we're going to look at the awareness of the impact of echo chambers and filter bubbles. And finally, we want to make sure you see a little bit about how teacher planning, global contexts, can help all subjects develop research skills. So, John, are you ready to go?
I'm always ready. Thank you, John. Pleasure to be here again, as usual. So I think we'll kick off with the my thoughts on and sharing, you know, is there a need for a distinction between information literacy and media literacy? For me, you know, I mean, information literacy is defined as the ability to identify that there is a need for information and to locate, evaluate, and use information to solve a problem, which involves understanding where to find information and how to evaluate it effectively. We look at media literacy, on the other hand, it's the ability to access, evaluate, manipulate, and produce media in a variety of forms. And it's more focused on how media works and how to produce media. But my thoughts on this is that, you know, when we map the skills, it's easy to see that there are many overlaps between information literacy and media literacy. And I think it's always, you know, prudent where we see an overlap, is there a possible for a meaningful merge to reduce you know, the pressure on teachers in terms of having to think they have to practice and develop, you know, another skill. If we merge it, then you're combining the two and it's a lot more efficient. So right. Just, you know, one of the examples I have from the skill indicators for information literacy is to gather information and perspectives from a variety of primary and secondary sources. Then we look at media literacy, and they've got locate, organize, analyze, evaluate, synthesize, and ethically use information from a variety of sources and media, including digital social media and online networks.
Right.
I think that's sort of a nod to how our students are more likely to, you know, conduct their research than from when you or I were at school, John. Right. So, you know, for me, I simply merged the two. So now that it's gathering information and perspectives from a variety of primary and secondary sources, including digital social media and online networks. And I think what also helps, I think, the merging of the two in certain areas is that the enhanced PYP, as they did with critical and creative thinking, they broke down the research into four parts, which was formulating and planning, data gathering and recording, synthesizing and interpreting, and evaluating and communicating. So when you look at that is within the information literacy, and then, you know, I looked at the strands for media literacy and then regrouped them in that order. So in my framework, I talk about research skills, yes, and it's information and information literacy and media literacy. I haven't got that separation because I think it makes it more efficient without denying students important learning opportunities. I also think, you know, part of my thought process with that, and, you know, some of our listeners may not agree, and that's, you know, that's fine. Again, there's the Google form. You can also share your thoughts on that as well. You know, but I do think due to, you know, the ubiquitous influence of technology, the ways in which our students gather and locate information is how we would have done. You know, as an example, My DP students last year, they found the TOK prescribed titles on a Reddit forum, literally like the same day that they were released by the IB. I haven't even had my lesson with them. And right. I had my students coming up to me saying, are these the prescribed titles? And I'm like, hang on, I've just got that email from the IB. How do you have it from a Reddit? And then like, oh, we got it on the Reddit forum. And, you know, I Google, I find the Reddit forum, and I see the prescribed titles already there. And I've got DP students have already sort of shared their thoughts of how they would answer the question and things like that. So already the students are able to access that information very easily using a website that definitely didn't exist when I was at school or at university.
Right.
And I think, you know, research skills, it's a very procedural skill, but it's also one that is heavily influenced, I think, by technological advancements within society. And according to the Pew Research Center, you know, it says that Americans aged 18 to 29 stand out in that the most common digital way they get news is social media, with 42% saying they get news this way often versus 28% saying either from news websites or search engines. Now, normally for me, when I would have got my information from news websites, but now, right. You know, if you think about it, if 18-year-olds are looking at social media and, you know, search engines, what do we think the younger generation are doing? You know, are they going to the Reddits? Are they going to, you know, Discord sites and things like that to find out that information? So I think as ATL skill coordinators and program coordinators, you know, we need to be mindful that, you know, if this is the environment that our students are growing up, you know, up in and around, merging the two where appropriate makes, you know, practical sense.
You know, you mentioned young people and the different ways in which people at different ages seek out information and gather information. You've done such a good job in the previous episodes about using the continuum and talking about the continuum, because you have a background in various programs. When it comes to research skills, can you give us kind of a quick tour of how the IB promotes research skills at different levels? Obviously, a DP student preparing for their extended essay is going to have a full set of skills, hopefully, by then, and will be developing them through the extended essay. But where do we begin? Where do we start with the early years or the primary years on through the middle years program and career-related program? What does the continuums have to say about these research skills?
That's a great question, John. I'm sure many of our listeners have that same sort of question in their mind as well when they're planning. I think, you know, one of, you know, the great things that the IB have done is when you look at the continuum, you see that, you know, there's emerging changes and developments as the programs go through their 5-year cycles. And I think, again, it's incumbent on us as either ATL coordinators or program coordinators to always look, you know, if you're an MYP coordinator, look, you know, to your left, so to speak, to see the PYP, look to your right to see what the DP is doing in that sort of sense. And you know, if you're the DP, you look, you know, backwards and see what the MYP and the PYP are doing. I really think what helps is that by breaking the research skills down into the four components, if you will, of formulating and planning, data gathering and recording, synthesizing and interpreting, and evaluating and communicating, those sort of four, if you want to call them components or overarching ideas, if you take them by themselves, they give a lot of flexibility, I think, for schools to decide what would they like to actually put into those four sections. So, for example, if you're looking at, you know, formulating and planning, part of that is looking at, you know, asking the students are expected in the PYP to ask or design relevant questions of interest that can be researched, to outline a plan for finding necessary information, and to evaluate and select appropriate information sources or digital tools based on the task. I think an effective model to use, particularly for the formulating and planning and getting the students to ask, you know, questions that are meaningful to be investigated or researched further, is the 5W1H model. And that is basically what, who, where, when, and how, and why. And sometimes the students may not go through all of the 5W1H components. You could do a class activity whereby one group focuses possibly on the what, another group focuses on the who, another group on the where, and so on and so forth. or you could allow the students to choose which of the five W1H model questions they wanted to sort of use with sort of a line of inquiry or a statement of inquiry that you may have given to the students in order for them to sort of essentially unpack the keywords that are part of that line of inquiry or the statement of inquiry or the context of maybe their theory of knowledge essay or their extended essay. The model is a perfect fit for the PYP. Getting the students to ask relevant questions that they're interested in and that they want to do further research about. And, you know, if you take a sort of maybe a line of inquiry and do the 5W1H process with the students, though, you know, they will generate their own questions, and then you give them that time to sort of, okay, if you want to answer this question, what maybe three things would you do to try to answer that question? Would you find an expert? Would you find a website? Would you find a book? That sort of thing.
Sure.
In the MYP, I would still use for that, you know, for the formulating and planning in that sense, you know, the 5W1H, because the beauty of 5W1H, it's such a simplistic tool to use that it can be manipulated very easily and modified and tailored to the age of the students that you're working with, so that, you know, they're still thinking of higher level sort of research questions and topics that they could be interested in. So instead of looking at a line of inquiry in the PYP, you could be looking at maybe a statement of inquiry for the MYP, or you could be looking at perhaps maybe a quote from an author or a poet that you want to use to sort of trigger the student's thought process in a lesson. I think in the last IDU exam, one of the questions just gave the students a quote and ask them to answer a question based on that quote. If they go through the process of the 5W1H, then they would have a better understanding of how to formulate and plan their investigation. Because essentially, if the students struggle to find and create a good research question, then the rest of the research may not be, and the rest of the investigation may not be a relevant or meaningful investigation for them to use. And again, that same process is applicable in the DP. And yeah, I'm saying you still can use the 5W1H, but again, you're using it with a bit more depth in relation to the topic or the area that you're interested in. And then again, you're just using the skill indicators as I would from the MYP and the DP, but the context, you know, the research that you're doing for an extended essay, is going to be more thorough than the research that you're going to do for your personal project, right, or your PYP exhibition. However, the process is the same. You need to formulate, you need to plan, you need to ask those relevant questions. Okay. Now, moving on a little bit to say sort of data gathering and recording. I think in the PYP, I think most of the students, most of their sources are likely to be perhaps maybe their parents, likely to be members of their family or their sort of close community in that sense. And I think that's perfectly fine for them to maybe ask their parents, what do they think about something? And I do also see in the PYP, I've seen students that will come visit the staff room and they will ask teachers questions to gather information. And they'll do like their tally chart of their answers, or they'll have like those sort of flipboards and they'll go around at break time and they'll ask questions of MYP students, or they'll, you know, they'll strike up the courage to interview somebody to ask certain questions. So in the PYP, I do see a lot of the students going around and seeking information from other adults, as opposed to always necessarily going straight on to, say, Google in that sense.
Right.
In the MYP, I think it's a shame that I haven't always seen that happen, whereby we see like MYP students necessarily going out to interview people in the school community. A lot of it is more sort of gathering information from, you know, the websites and online resources and things like that. And then I think that leads into the DP as well. What I'd say is would be, you know, good for schools to consider is, you know, look at how you can see the investigations happening in the PYP in terms of the students going out, actively asking individuals, creating those surveys. And that's really got to continue all the way through the continuum as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, John, given the misinformation that we're surrounded by, how can we help students develop authentic research skills that go beyond just Google it?
You know, this is such an important question, John. And I think before considering authentic research skills, we need to focus our students' mindset inwards with a nod towards the states of mind, which again is why it's at the core of, you know, the international award-winning skills framework I developed, because the skills are not meant to be used in isolation. And I think we need to accept two things. The first is that we as humans, we all have bias, and that can be conscious or unconscious. The second is that our search engines and social media sites do use algorithms. And these algorithms are built and designed by humans. Thus, there is that likelihood that search engines and social media sites do contain an element of bias. And I think that the risk is that we can cultivate either an echo chamber, whereby we surround ourselves with individuals, whether family, friends, or media personality, who only agree with us. And, you know, in the past, that might have just been a sort of local physical community, that we'd surround ourselves with friends that thought the way that we thought and that sort of thing. Now with, you know, technology and the internet, we can connect with different people from across the globe at different time zones that all share that same sort of opinion and values that we hold, but we're still creating that echo chamber. Whereas a filter bubble is defined as a state of intellectual isolation that can result from personalized searches when the website algorithm selectively guesses what information a user would like to see based on information about the user, such as the location, past click behavior, and the past search history. You know, I think we see that in a harmless way when we're on YouTube. And if we've watched a few videos of a certain topic or personal area of interest, we will see that those sorts of videos come up in, you know, the YouTube feed, if you will, a lot more often. And that's just on YouTube, you know, watching videos type thing. But if you're using that, you know, if the filter bubble, if we're looking at how we're acquiring news, how we're acquiring information about the world around us, and if the algorithms then do create that filter bubble, then I think that is, a danger into already sort of walking in unknowingly into a world of misinformation. But you may not know that you've done that, because that's just how we act and how we behave online.
Right.
I mean, I know that's, you know, taking it a bit away from, you know, your original question there, John. But I do think in order to answer that, we do need to sort of understand that this is the reality in which we are currently in, and which our students from across the, you know, the continuum are engaging with, you know, and using technology. Like, for example, for, you know, us, we haven't had that much use of technology in comparison to someone who's, you know, gone in the PYP at this moment in time, in terms of what they're Googling, what they're searching, and things like that. And therefore, they could already have created those filter bubbles. I think a way to address that is, once you've raised awareness of that, right, is to try sort of in terms of raising awareness, I see no harm in the session being done with, you know, students, age appropriate, that sort of has these sorts of discussions and makes them aware that these things do exist, so they can sort of hopefully self-regulate themselves with regards to their, you know, their internet usage sure. In that sense.
Do you advocate for giving them different tools like the endings of .edu or .gov or other types of endings that will give them something besides what the .com searches would do?
Yeah, I do believe that using those strategies would be beneficial and would be useful to help combat that in certain situations, yes. I think, again, I would look to, you know, what do the skill indicators have? Do they provide a pathway for that? And under the research skills, you know, the students are required to seek a range of perspectives from multiple and varied sources. So as educators, you know, we need to do that in our lessons too, to make sure that the resources that we share with the students do come from a variety of either cultural perspectives, you know, and making sure that we reduce the elements of bias that might seep through. You know, as an example, you know, when I'm teaching TOK, I'll use a lot of resources from, you know, The Guardian, Vox, Huffington Post, and, you know, The Daily Show, those sorts of things. And then, you know, I thought to myself, am I really being fair to my students? Because then they are, when they're doing their research, they're going to automatically go to these sorts of websites. So I thought, you know, should I take resources from the likes of Fox News, which is kind of the opposite spectrum to, say, The Guardian in the UK or the Huffington Post type thing.
Right.
And I decided that I should do so, so that my students know where they can go to sort of seek a range of different perspectives from multiple and varied sources. You know, doctors will say that, you know, we use everything in moderation. So, you know, if we spend our time only getting news from one source or one ideological source, it will increase the risk of filter bubbles. And again, if we think about it, our students have accessed the internet since they've been in PYP, and that potential harm is immense. And I think that would then impact just like a whole host of skills. I think it then moves on to how do we as educators counter that threat so that they can develop those authentic research skills.
Right.
As with my framework, it's about finding a model or models that can support them. And for me, there are two that I think are very effective for the primary years, and that is the Super 3 and the MYP and above, it's the Big 6. And these are basically research steps that align very, very well with the way that the PYP have broken down research skills into those four areas, as I've said before. I have included the link so listeners can get that from the podcast as well in more detail. Yep. Then what I've always done in, say, the task sheets, when we do the task sheets for the students in INS, we incorporate the Big 6 by aligning it with the assessment strands for Criteria B investigation. So that when they're applying the model, it tells us how effectively or not students are able to research. But it gives the students that procedural step-by-step process of what they need to do and when they need to do and what sort of information do they need to get. The Big 6, it doesn't have to be used in its totality. You could, you know, use it in parts. It certainly wouldn't, you know, I certainly wouldn't advocate using the Big 6 in one whole lesson. You probably want to break it up because I doubt students can do meaningful research within, say, you know, a 40 or 80 minute lesson in that sense. And, you know, certain steps of the Big 6 in the learning experiences they plan for the students, you know, even for subjects that may not be thought of as associated with research, can still also use the Big 6.
Yeah. And again, as I said last week, if these terms are new to you, the Big 6 or the Super 3, you know, while you're listening to the podcast, pause for a second, open up your computer, take a look at the links that we've got in the notes and kind of see what he's talking about, because links that we're providing and the resources that are being gathered for you are something that you can refer to many times as you continue building your ATL skills framework and your team in your building. So yeah, thanks for that, John. So one of the things, you know, I was a science teacher and you're an INS teacher. Both of them are, I think, typically thought of as researched heavy subject areas and thrive on good quality research. But there are other subjects that we don't kind of align with that thinking or think that they're aligned with research. How do we encourage those skills in those subjects that are not typically associated with research?
Great question, John. I think what we need to do as educators, to be honest, is to, you know, really dispel the notion that certain subjects may not associate themselves with research skills. You know, I'd say that within the subjects, then naturally, you could say, yes, INS, as you said, science and design, you could argue, you know, it's a given that those subjects will include opportunities for students to acquire and practice research skills. But when you think about it, when you look at the, you know, the assessment criteria expectations for the MYP in that sense, you know, students do need to research into the arts for knowledge and understanding about certain art movements or a particular artist. If you look at PHE, you know, students will need to research about parts of the body or tactics or, you know, healthy diets. They, you know, I've asked my students in the past, you know, to watch videos of athletes running so that they can see in practice, how do the students run versus the athletes compare, and then against their own running style, and then can they make their own running style more efficient? You know, in language acquisition, not only are you learning a second language, but you're also learning about another culture. So there are many opportunities for research skills to be developed there in terms of finding out about cultural festivals and celebrations, and perhaps how do they differ or how are they similar to the cultural festivals and celebrations of the host country or things like that. I think also in language and literature, when you're considering the context of when a play, novel or poem was written, then that really does open the door for research skills, which you then need because with all the examples I've given, you know, those research skills enrich your understanding and appreciation for the subject and the topic that you're working in. You know, if you read a poem, I want to mention my favorite poet is Maya Angelou, and I love her poem, Still I Rise. As educators, you can create that learning experience whereby students can research into Maya Angelou's life, the context by which, I mean, you know, the broader historical events that may have influenced the poet to, you know, write Still I Rise. It's said that, you know, it was written to portray the resilience of Black people in response to racial discrimination and injustice. With that, you know, you've got a meaningful IDU right there with INS, if you link that with civil rights and movements. But again, knowing that the context helps students to appreciate aspects of language and literature, that's where the research skills comes into it. And, you know, when I saw this question on the document, John, I thought, what am I going to say for mathematics, though? Because mathematics is really, it's really not my forte. But as luck would have it, the other day I was having a chat with Nigel, my principal at UCSI. And, you know, so I'm going to tell this story on his behalf. He was sharing with me when he was teaching in Antwerp in Belgium, and they had to measure the circumference and the height of a tree for a maths topic. Through the process of boring, the students could see the rings of the tree. And they gathered data on the rings within the tree, noticing how some had smaller gaps than others. And then, you know, through that observation, then naturally students began to ask questions, which then enabled them to realize that a combination of historical and geographical factors led to the change that they could see through the rings of the tree. And therefore, that allowed them to do some research into around about 1946, where the gap was small. What happened? Well, that's making a link into, you know, World War II and those sorts of events. So I think a lot of it is incumbent on, you know, teachers to really think about the topics that they're teaching and how can they create a meaningful research element in it. I mean, I don't think you need to have it in every single unit, but I would say that, you know, each subject does hold a responsibility above and beyond, you know, INS science and design, I'd say, to develop research skills with their students.
I was just going to say, I look at this also kind of like the way, you know, we're told that we're all language teachers. And I think you understand that, especially if you're an IB teacher, because you understand the role of language in expressing and understanding your subject area. But also when you mentioned the I think we're all research teachers, and it gives great power to the teacher to say, hey, wait, you know, I'm a language teacher, but I'm also, I can help students better understand my subject area if they do some research. You were talking about math examples there. That was a great one. I can imagine, you know, doing the core sampling, like you're talking about in the boring, you know, imagine the talk about rate, you know, and you can, you know, the kids can be working with the concept of rate. I saw one of my favorite math teachers I follow on Twitter was just showing some essentially clear plastic sheets she handed out to kids that had markers on them with different angles. And so they were to walk around nature and see if they could find the angle in the environment. So they're walking outside with a clear plastic sheet that had an angle on it. That's all how simple it was. And they're lining them up with tree branches. They're lining them up with architectural features and buildings, looking at those kind of things in the world and realizing that there's a role for certain, you know, applications of math understanding. So I there's some good examples out there for sure.
Yeah. And I think because naturally the programs are collaborative in nature, if you're perhaps maybe a little bit unsure about how you could incorporate a research element into your unit, then by all means ask one of your other colleagues, you know, for their thoughts and their suggestions about how they could go about it. And that's good for that collaborative process. Who knows, you could get a really meaningful IDU touch point or even develop, you know, an IDU unit as part of that process. It doesn't always have to be an IDU unit either. And I think naturally, you know, the unit of inquiry in the PYP, that helps students see the significance of research skills in a range of subjects because the nature of that unit of inquiry encompasses information and skills from more than just one subject and the connections between the two, between the range of subjects used there. And in the MYP, I think, you know, the global context and concepts can really help the research skills come out in other subjects where it may be, you know, traditionally thought, you know, those skills aren't important for my subject. And again, it's really important that, you know, as educators, we take on that responsibility that when we're planning the learning experiences to identify, you know, what I would call those low-hanging branches with or without the transparent paper, whereby it's easy and relevant to include research skills, you know, into a lesson for the students.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, we've touched on all the things that we had set out to do. Is there anything else that you want to talk about before we wrap things up this week?
I think from an INS point of view, when we're looking at the research skills there, the expectations for the students based on the assessment criteria are really important. I think in M1, the students need to choose a research question, which means that we as educators need to sort of give them, you know, one or two research questions to choose from. I think as part of that process, we need to be spending that time making sure that, you know, the discussion is had with the students about what makes a good, what are the good components of a research question. Mm-hmm. And again, you can lean back on the 5W1H model as part of that process. So it's a really amazingly versatile model that you can use either to help students to create an effective research question, or you can use that model to get students to analyze and say, M1, what makes the good components of a research question, so that when they move into M2, that they're able to take that on board and then start to create and formulate their own research questions.
Yeah. And listeners will hear in what we've been talking about, what John's been saying, is the role of the continuum in reaching the point where an excellent research question can be developed in your TOK project or in your extended essay for the diploma mm-hmm. students. That is such an, you know, for me, in my experience, we did not have long-term feeders, and a lot of the students in our classrooms had not had a whole lifetime of IB education. And so trying to start out with a 16, 17-year-old developing a good research question, it's heavy lifting. And so having a continuum school, you know, for those of you that have one, you are in a great position to really build these skills up through the continuum and get students to a point. And, you know, not even for the purpose of doing IB well, but just to, you know, attack research in life with a good respect for what a good question would be.
Yeah, totally agree, John.
Yeah, great. Well, I want to thank you again for your time this week, John. As always, I've learned a lot. It's informative, I hope. Our feedback has been excellent. Those of you listening, please continue to listen and use the links that John's provided in our podcast notes and the resources that have been developed, either looking at our podcast notes or look directly at the IB Matters podcast website, because we've got tons of information for you there that's all gathered in one place. So thanks again. Next week, we are talking about communication skills, and I'm sure it'll be just as good as the previous episodes have been. It's really great. So thanks again, John, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you very much, John. See you next week as well. Cheerio.
You can learn much more about ATLs and other aspects of the IB Pre-K to 12 Continuum of Education using links in our podcast notes, as well as on the IB website at ibo.org. Now that we have over 90 IB Matters episodes covering a range of subjects, you can use our podcast webpage, which is organized by program and by topic. The link to the website is also in our podcast notes. Please find all of our episodes wherever you get your podcasts and click subscribe so you don't miss any future programs. Join our over 3,500 followers on Twitter at MattersIB. Also, help us spread the word about IB by liking, sharing, and reviewing the IB Matters links in your own feeds and social networks. In our time on the air, we've been heard in over 150 countries, a testament to the global reach of the IB.